I think the coming decades will be a time when neuroscience really goes forward exponentially. We will be able to influence the basic human condition, our cognitive abilities, our mood, and even perhaps our romantic relationships. Further down the track, we may even be interfering in early human development or contributing to augmenting early human development or even genetic engineering.
The attraction of a brain scan is it appears to be objective data. In a world of values and arguments and impressions, here you've got objective datum, a bit of the brain lighting up. The fact that that datum actually is irrelevant doesn't seem to matter too much. It's objective, and of course, it does have the glamour of high science, of leading-edge technology, and people are suckers for technology.
The philosophers Julian Savulescu and Ray Tallis. Savulescu, a bioethicist from Oxford, has a breathless optimism about the potential of neuroscience to make us better humans. Tallis, once a practicing doctor, fears that the glamour of brain science is seducing us for all the wrong reasons. This is no abstract debate. Politicians, policymakers, lawyers, all are turning to neuroscience to help answer fundamental questions about human nature and to shape everything from social policy to courtroom verdicts. So who's right? Can a better understanding of our brains help us create better societies and live better lives? Or is it a dangerous fad, and one perhaps with dark ethical consequences?
How are you doing? Everything okay? Fantastic job, well done. So we're just going to take another little pause again, just so you can relax a little bit. It should be a couple of minutes, okay?
That's the sound of the hottest neuroscientific technology, fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, or brain scans to you and me. What is it, and why are so many people excited by it? Geraint Rees, Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London.
A functional MRI scanner is like a hospital brain scanner, an MRI scanner, but it's adapted so it can produce pictures not just of the brain's structure, what the brain looks like, but also the brain's function, what areas are lighting up when we think. And the way it does that is by measuring the oxygen that's carried on hemoglobin in red blood cells as it goes to the tissues. The neurons in the brain, when they become active, use that oxygen, and that's measured by the scanner and enables us to measure which bits light up when we think. In the early days of functional MRI, about 15, 20 years ago, it was often used just to map what areas of the brain are associated with analysis of particular aspects of how the brain processes information. More recently, it's used essentially to answer questions and test hypotheses about how the brain works.
What's really attracted attention is not the scientific, but the social potential of fMRI. Stephen Lakin is CEO of Cephos, an American company at the forefront of the social use of the technology.
People have used functional MRI for everything from understanding diseases, things like Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, to understanding political preferences and determining what makes a person like a specific candidate, to even understanding why it is that we choose the things that we choose, something called neuromarketing. And then what our company works on is something called deception, which is essentially looking at the parts of the brain that people are using when they're lying or telling the truth.
Many of Cephos's clients are private individuals, people who might want to check whether their children are lying or their spouse is cheating. But increasingly, it's governments and state institutions being seduced by the idea that a scan of the brain gives a glimpse of the person's soul. In India, a 23-year-old woman, Aditha Sharma, was convicted of murder last year on the evidence of a brain scan. In America, a convicted murderer might receive a retrial after brain scan evidence submitted by Cephos suggested that he might originally have told the truth. And in Britain, Cephos say they have talked to the Home Office about the use of fMRI technology to help decide whether paedophiles are safe for release. The Home Office says it has no intention of using brain scan data, though the Ministry of Justice is currently piloting polygraph technology on sex offenders. But how scientifically robust is the fMRI technology upon which all this is based? Stephen Lakin.
We've published the largest studies with the most complete set of people of any place. And what our studies show is that the accuracy rates range from 75% to 97%.
But even if it's say 90% accuracy, that still means that one case in 10 you're going to get wrong. That's a major problem, isn't it?
Virtually all of forensic evidence or any measurement that man makes has an error rate. DNA evidence has an error rate. Fingerprints have an error rate. The problem with most forensic evidence outside of DNA is that the error rates aren't known. We know that fingerprints aren't perfect. We know that fiber analysis, treadmark, toolmark, shoe analysis have error rates. They're not perfect. It's not definitive 100%. We have an error rate. We can define that error rate, and it's really up to the jury to decide what weight to put on that error rate.
Because DNA fingerprinting also has a certain error rate, so there is nothing to worry about brain scan evidence. I'm not sure that's a particularly convincing argument. But it's not just in the courtroom that advocates of fMRI see its uses. In an age in which terrorism creates an all-pervasive fear, the technology is being touted as a magic bullet in the war on terror. Stephen Lakin again.
In terms of security, there's a number of things. Understanding whether or not people have preferences for specific fundamental groups, and understanding whether people may have seen a place. So you can actually look at the neuroscience images in a person's brain and determine whether or not someone's been to a place before. So if a person was in an Al-Qaeda training camp, that would only be specific to them. You can actually determine that, as well as understanding languages. When did a person learn a language? Was it their first language? Was it their second language? Was it a language that they learned later on in life versus a language that they learned at birth?
According to some, the spooks may already be poring over brain scans. Paul Root-Wolpe is professor of medicine and of bioethics at Emory University in Atlanta. He's also NASA's chief bioethicist. Does he believe that there's some secret government lab somewhere trying to develop fMRI as a counter-terrorist weapon?
There's no question about it. There already are programs in the government looking at brain imaging for lie detection and for other purposes. We know this not only because there are funding streams that we've seen in some of the research agencies, but also because some of the people who have originated this research in the academy have gotten calls from some of the security agencies asking them technical questions that they would only really need to know if they were trying it themselves. So there's very little question that these technologies are of great interest to military and security concerns.
But whatever may be the interest in the Pentagon or at Langley, Geraint Reese, for one, remains sceptical about the usefulness of brain scan technology to the spooks or even to the police.
It's not a useful use of the technology at this stage. It seems to me to be going a really long way ahead of things to suggest that brain scanning technology is somehow a panacea that will address or answer these questions. We know that brain imaging and lie detection technology can sometimes work better than chance, that is, it's better than just tossing a coin and guessing. But for most legal situations, one wants to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt.
Ray Tallis has a deeper concern about the way that such technology makes us conceive of what is a lie or a truth. As a former doctor who specialised in the rehabilitation of people with brain damage, he is well used to reading brain scans and is enthusiastic about their medical potential. As a philosopher, however, he worries that the social use of fMRI rests on an impoverished view of the human thought process.
Lies are quite complicated things, and there are different kinds of lies. But more profound than that is the assumption that, say, lying is associated with activity within a particular region of the brain. If I'm telling a lie, I'm mobilising all sorts of things in my consciousness, in my world, in my awareness of the world, and I don't think that looking at brain activity in the way we do could tell you whether you were lying or not, because lies are not those kinds of things, like responses to stimuli, which can be examined usefully using these techniques. I cannot imagine a situation where there is a simple one-to-one mapping between a lying statement as opposed to a true statement and what is seen on scanning.
Of course, many people would say it's quite possible to distinguish between a truth and a lie by looking at brain activity, and that this is precisely what brain scans have taught us. But it's not just questions of truth or falsity for which people turn to brain scans for answers. It's also questions of responsibility and intentionality. Was an individual responsible for his actions? Did he intend to commit an act? Scans can detect brain damage, and this is beginning to change the way that the legal profession in particular thinks about how and why people act.
State your name for the record.
Dr. James Brewer.
Okay. Dr. Brewer, Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but
the American Association for the Advancement of Science recently held a mock trial to explore the use of neuroscientific evidence. The prosecutor was played by Hank Greeley, professor of law at Stanford University, and the world's leading expert in the ethical implications of the legal use of bioscience.
The story was ex-boyfriend murders his ex-girlfriend. It turns out later that he has a major damaged area in his frontal lobes. The defense tries to argue that because of the extent of that frontal lobe damage, he would not have been able at the time of the crime either to plan to kill her, which goes to the legal requirement of premeditation for first degree for the highest level of murder, or even to intend to kill her, which goes to second degree and other levels of murder. A couple of things about it that really interested me. One was the expert for the defense put up an MRI of a normal brain and then shortly thereafter put up an MRI of the supposed defendant's brain. And there was a big black area, empty area in the frontal lobes. There were about 150 people in the audience, and I think every one of them gasped. I've never heard such a loud from a group before because it was so dramatic. The other thing that was interesting was the audience's decision. The audience said no. They didn't think we had proven that he had premeditated. Then we asked, had we proven that he had killed with intent? The audience said that we had. There was nothing about the lesion in the frontal lobe that would say he couldn't premeditate, but he could intend. The audience, I think, looked at that hole in his brain and said, well, we want to cut him some slack. We believe that this must have had some effect, but they weren't willing to say it had so much effect that he was not guilty at all.
What this suggests is that the public is perhaps more savvy about the implications of neuroscience than many politicians or policymakers or philosophers. Rather than see neuroscience as transforming their view of human behaviour, this audience, at least, seemed to view the neuroscientific evidence in the light of what they already knew of human conduct. For some, however, the new science of the brain will inevitably transform our notions of human nature, and therefore of what it means for an individual to act or to believe. And not just those who are obviously brain damaged. Deborah Denno is Professor of Law at New York's Fordham University. She is leading a campaign for the law to acknowledge that people are not always fully in control of their actions.
Criminal law is based on the concept that you're either acting voluntarily or involuntarily. And if you act involuntarily, oftentimes you're totally acquitted from the criminal justice system and nothing is done to you. There's an example in your country recently of a man in Wales who killed his wife while he was sleeping. And there was every indication that he was acting unconsciously and involuntarily when he killed her because he was having bad dreams and he had a history of sleep disorders. But your criminal justice system acquitted him entirely, as ours would, too, given that kind of situation, which, you know, is a good result because he didn't seem to be responsible for his actions. At the same time, he committed a really serious crime, and there's nothing to suggest that he would have to be obligated to anybody in the future with respect to his behavior. He wouldn't have to take drugs or any kind of medication or medical supervision to make sure that he doesn't do this again.
So your notion is to have a third category, a category of semi-voluntary acts, is it not?
That's right. This would be a category of semi-voluntary acts where there might be an indication that some people are a little bit more aware than we had normally considered them to be. And also some suggestion that some people commit serious acts and maybe they shouldn't be totally acquitted from the criminal justice system. Now, along with that concept, however, is the idea that the criminal justice system assumes that people act intentionally too much. In other words, there's a presumption that we're all intentional actors for the most part. And I think the new consciousness research would suggest that perhaps there's a category of people who aren't acting as intentionally as the criminal law has assumed that they have been in the past.
It's not just lawyers looking to neuroscience to help transform practice. Politicians and policymakers are even more enthusiastic. Ian Duncan Smith is one of them. 6 years ago, the former Conservative Party leader founded a think tank, the Centre for Social Justice, and has since devoted himself to the task of transforming Britain's social and welfare policies. Early Intervention, a report jointly produced by the Centre for Social Justice and the Labour-supporting Smith Institute, uses the latest brain research to argue that government intervention is best targeted in the first 3 years of a child's life.
If you're talking about something like early intervention, I think you need really to be evidence-led on this. And what neuroscience is now telling us is that there is a physical issue here, that something that is happening. What neuroscience tells us categorically is that, unlike the rest of the animal kingdom, we are, in a sense, almost born into intensive care, in the sense that we are born almost a year early, I guess, if you compare us to monkeys or whatever it is. Therefore, the relationship between the nurturer, the mother, let's call it the mother at the moment, and the child assumes staggering importance, because that's challenging the brain, and the child is trying to accommodate the mother. And what's going on there is something very physical, which is that the brain is developing. It's that challenge is causing the brain to stimulate certain areas in its development that actually then allows that brain to develop in a balanced way. So what we have to do is work with the mother to change the mother to change the child.
Politicians taking an interest in science is, of course, something to be welcomed, as is the attempt to root social policy in scientific fact. But does neuroscience really provide the evidence that Ian Duncan Smith believes it does in favour of early intervention? Some neuroscientists think that the plasticity of the infant brain may be an argument for ensuring that a child's first experiences are particularly beneficial. Others, however, are far more sceptical. A few years ago, I made another analysis programme on the question of early intervention. I talked to a number of neuroscientists, including John Brewer, Director of the Cognitive Studies for Educational Practice at the James McDonald Foundation in St. Louis, Missouri.
There is no neuroscientific research that supports the claim that the first 3 years are critical for all these various kinds of development, and that is the only time educators can usefully intervene to help children. There are clearly critical periods for certain kinds of development. Typically vision, hearing, acquiring a first language. Beyond that, the evidence is very slim, but the belief that there are long-term consequences from early childhood that carry into adult life across a wide range of skills and abilities, we'll find that claim is not warranted.
My answer to that is, you know, you're in the middle of a general debate amongst neuroscientists as well about the application of theirs, and you'll have always people very reluctant to draw any major conclusions. That's what scientists do. They hate people drawing major conclusions on anything except pure science. We're not saying that neuroscience told us this, that that's why we're here. What the neuroscience does in this area is confirming quite a lot of already understood social work that is going on.
Ian Duncan Smith. Perhaps he's right. But then, should the argument for early intervention not stand on its own two feet? If there is no consensus among neuroscientists, why make an issue of the science? In roping in neuroscience to back a political policy, are politicians not exploiting the status and authority of science to add weight to their favoured policies? The doctor and philosopher Ray Tallis.
I find it very interesting that politicians, both left and right, are looking to neuroscience to validate some of their policies or some of their ideas. When you hear politicians talking about neuroscience, often they will tell us that brain scans have shown us something we actually knew already from, you know, much better source of information, such as our general knowledge of the world. But of course, if you place a brain scan next to a statement, then it suddenly becomes much more interesting. A truism becomes a revelation. And I think people are very much under the spell of the glamour of neuroscience. They suddenly think they're seeing the mind, the soul, the truth. And I have to tell you, what they're seeing is brain activity, which is none of those things.
Ray Tallis is sceptical because he has a particular conception of what it means for humans to think and to act. He accepts the data of brain scans, but he also thinks that they're largely irrelevant to the task of formulating social policies or engaging in political action, because they describe the processes of human thought at a level far removed from that on which policy or action impinges. Others, however, have a very different conception of human thought and action, and therefore about the utility of neuroscience in a social context. They believe that the data emerging from the new science of the brain are changing our very conceptions of human nature. Julian Savulescu is director of Oxford University's Centre for Practical Ethics. He believes that only through understanding the brain can we overcome the moral frailties of the human race.
We will have to have a better understanding of human moral limitation, and we will have to start to inculcate certain values and certain forms of morality rather than being very neutral, as we traditionally have been in liberal societies, to different conceptions of the good life, religious traditions and different versions of morality.
But who decides what's morally right and wrong? Who decides whether such behaviour needs neuroenhancing?
There are two essential views of ethics: a subjective view that says it's just what people desire or just what people want, or it's relative to cultures, or a more objective view that says no, certain things are right or wrong, whether or not people want them. And I personally hold a more objective view, and there are large areas of convergence when you look at moral development over the last centuries. We agree that slavery is wrong, sexism is wrong. So we need to start looking at those common points of agreement, what's objective about ethics and about what's objectively valuable about our society, and really try to promote that.
That seems to suggest that if, for instance, we could, through the use of a pill, stop people being racist, we should promote that.
When you say give people pills, it has a sort of totalitarian ring to it. But if I said to you, we should educate people to be less racist, everyone would be in favour of that. But education changes the structure of people's brains. And if indeed our understanding of biology can augment that process, I can't see a reason for why we shouldn't embrace that kind of use of knowledge and technology. Although I understand that people will be frightened of it.
But isn't the difference this, that education requires having a conversation, a dialogue, a debate, whereas taking a pill requires none of that?
If it were something that people voluntarily chose to engage in, there wouldn't be a problem. The complex case is going to be where the person doesn't want to have this kind of intervention. And there you have to look at the social effects. So if somebody's racism is essentially something that remains in their own home, in their own minds, doesn't influence their treatment of other people, then it wouldn't be a reason for society to intervene against their wishes. If somebody was engaged in violent racist attacks against other people, harming those other people, there would be much stronger reasons for intervening, even against their will.
Professor Savulescu's argument raises profound questions about what ethics are, about what it means to be a moral person, and about how we make better citizens. Over the next decade, as our understanding of the brain increases, as well as our ability to manipulate neural processes, it won't be just university professors who will have to wrestle with such questions, but politicians, policymakers, teachers, doctors, and you and me too. Professor Savulescu's argument also raises more immediate and concrete ethical questions, particularly about privacy. The bioethicist Paul Root Wolpe.
For the first time in human history, we can actually get information directly from a person's brain. And what that means is that this area that throughout human thought and human self-conception has always been a closed, private realm of thought, dreaming, ideas, beliefs, is now potentially open to others for the first time. And if the idea of privacy means anything at all, I believe, it means our right to keep that realm of human existence private to ourselves, to not allow anyone else access to the inner workings of our own minds. Sartre talked about the idea that the ultimate power of a human being is the power to say no. The power that if I need somehow to resist tyranny, or if I believe that I've been wronged, my ultimate power is refusal to cooperate. What this technology potentially takes away from us, and we need to add here that right now you can't use brain imaging coercively in any way. But if we were to get to the point where we could actually scan brains against people's will or without their knowledge, we will have taken away that last refuge of resistance, the ability of a person to refuse to cooperate, to refuse to participate in their own interrogation or oppression. And that, to me, is a very scary prospect and quite different than other forms of communication.
Whether or not you worry depends, of course, on how powerful you think neuroscientific technology really is. If you accept that a brain scan really is a window into the human soul, then you may well have a legitimate fear that this technology could have devastating consequences for one's right to privacy. If, on the other hand, you think, like Ray Tallis does, that thoughts are more than simply neural activity, then you may be a bit more sanguine. Fear of neuroscience and hype about it are, ironically, two sides of the same coin. But whatever view we take on what brain scans reveal about ourselves, the advance of neuroscience will inevitably still raise profound ethical and political questions. Hank Greeley, professor of law at Stanford University.
We really are in the middle of an incredible revolution in our understanding of the human brain. And compared to 30 years ago, we know infinitely more now. Compared to 30 years from now, we probably know effectively zero. The new tools are really allowing us to understand what's happening in living human brains so much better than we ever could before. Almost 1% of the adult population in the world has schizophrenia, and they almost all are diagnosed between the ages of about 18 and 30. If we could predict which 15-year-olds with high accuracy are going to be diagnosed with schizophrenia in the next 15 years, how would we use that information? Would we decide that maybe we don't want to let them become police officers or members of the military? And then there's antisocial behavior. Most crime is committed by a relatively small number of people. What if we could do a brain scan of 12-year-old boys and figure out with high accuracy which ones are going to be criminals in the future? What would we do? Would we put them in jail and throw away the key? Would we put them in treatment that may or may not work? Would we warn the neighbors about them? Would we have them wear GPS bracelets? You know, what would we do with that information? As an academic, my bias is that information is good and more information is better. But that's not always true in the real world.
What is striking about these questions is that the answers do not lie in the province of neuroscience alone. They demand instead that we first take a stand on the broader issues, about what it means to lie, about what it means to act with intention, about what it means to be moral, about what it means to be human. Neuroscience cannot answer such questions. Rather, we have to interpret neuroscientific data in the light of answers we've already come to. And that, perhaps, is the real challenge of neuroscience in the coming decades. Not to provide the easy answers, but to provoke us into thinking about the difficult questions.